Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is K. Quincy Parker and today is a solo show. I am without Matthew today and I apologize for those of you, and I apologize to those of you who will no doubt miss Matthew's very intense contributions to our time together, and I hope that you are able to enjoy what you and I get up to today. So, in place of Matthew asking me how I'm doing, I'm going to pretend that the listener has asked me the same question, and I will say that all is well in K. Quincy Parker land. An old friend of mine from my days in the diplomatic corps in D.C. Referred to K. Quincy Parker land as Parkenistan. So here in Parkenistan, things are going incredibly well. Life is good with respect to, I suppose, what one might call my day job, and with regard to the avocation that I follow, you will have heard me speak from time to time about the fact that I am a composer by training. My college degree is music composition / technology. So I have been writing a lot of music lately, and quite enjoying the process of being a composer and an arranger in a country where there is an outlet for the music that I write. This is a very, over the last, let's say, two decades, I would say it's been a real journey to find outlets for original compositions in the Bahamas, especially for those ensembles that are not vocal ensembles. But the instrumental culture in the Bahamas has grown tremendously over the last 20 years. And so I, as a composer, can write for choirs, I can write for soloists and small chamber ensembles, I can write for solo instruments, I can write for instrumental ensembles, and for orchestra, more or less. And it is quite a wonderful development to witness. And so, to the members of the performing arts community, particularly those in the music community, I just want to say, you know, it's been wonderful watching you grow and growing alongside you. Last year, I finished my third opera, and I had started working with the local performing arts community to see about putting it on the stage at the Dundas, but we all know where the Dundas is at the moment. But it is something that is still on the drawing board, so to speak. So it is my hope and prayer that in the next few years I will be able to put up a new opera at the Dundas or some other performing arts venue here in the Bahamas. And I'm looking really forward to that. It puts me in mind of the traditions that I am following as a Bahamian composer. You know, I'm following in the tradition of Timothy Gibson, Clement Bethel, Cleophas Adderley. And of those three, I have really, as much as I enjoy Clement Bethel's work, I worked with Cleophas Adderley as part of the National Youth Choir And I told Cleophas this during a symposium, a Bahamian composer symposium that was held at University of the Bahamas some years ago. What I told him was that my time in the National Youth Choir was really formative of my style as a choral composer. And I remember one thing in particular that Cleophas did. He had written this music and had this idea for a song, Fishman, Conchman. And he didn't really have the words that he wanted. And so he sat at the piano in the St. John's Auditorium, which is where the choir used to meet and practice. And he called us around him and asked us to help him write the lyrics. And I remember participating in that and how amazing it was to go from helping to write the lyrics to this wonderful composition, and to go from that to performing it on stage in the Bahamas, and we performed it in Canada, and it was as I said to him, that moment really was one of the moments that set me on my journey as a composer. And so to Cleophas' family, I told him while he was still with us, and you all know how much I valued him as a mentor, even though he thought I was a great big ball of mischief. I don't know how many times he kicked me out of the National Youth Choir and then asked me back. But anyway, that is, yeah. So the short version of this is it's been really fun to watch as the music community has matured over the last 20 years here in these Isles of June. Now that we're done with my trip down memory lane, I want to turn to the reason for today's podcast. We call it the Sunday Scotch Society, but as our regular listeners will know, we don't only drink scotch. And today I am once again returning to the bourbon well, and today's sip is a really, really special one. It is the Rowan's Creek Straight Kentucky Bourbon out of the Willette Distillery in Kentucky. It's in Bardstown, Kentucky. And I love the Willette Distillery. I think that the conscientious listener will remember from the Willette Distillery, we have sipped the Noah's Mill Bourbon before. It's another small batch offering out of the Willette Distillery. And the Noah's Mill was quite exquisite. So I'm really excited about sipping the Rowan's Creek and sharing it with you here on the Sunday Scotch Society today. The first thing I would like to do is, I guess, share a bit of the history of the Rowan's Creek and of the Willette Distillery. So, Willette Distillery itself was established in 1936 by Thompson Willette, but the website tells a story that goes back quite a long ways. His grandfather and his father made sure that Thomas had a deep knowledge and respect for the craftsmanship involved in making fine whiskies. And just a note here, the term whiskey is itself a class of beverages. Whiskey is the name given to the way this particular type of beverage is distilled. So that means that there are Scotch whiskeys, Irish whiskeys, there are Japanese whiskeys, and American whiskeys. And for the most part, American whiskeys fall into the bourbon category, although there are some distillers in New York and some other places who are making whiskey. And what distinguishes bourbon as a whiskey itself is that the main grain that is used in the mash is corn, and to a lesser extent, rye. And so that is that's what whiskey means. And with respect to the Ouellette distillery, the lessons that Thompson Ouellette, who founded the distillery in 1936, learned from his dad and granddad was a fairly simple sort of a mantra. Use the best ingredients available, pay close attention to the details, then take a step back and give the whiskey time and space to develop character. That is the Ouellette approach, and as somebody who has sampled their whiskey on many occasions, I can tell you that that approach bears an incredible fruit. It is really, really delicious. So I have as a whiskey drinker, I'm always interested in the story of the whiskey. But this is maybe not necessarily the best sort of avenue or platform to really dive deeply into the Ouellette distillery history, because if I did that, then I would spend the whole time talking about the Ouellette distillery history, because it goes all the way back to the 1600s. In 17 something, John Ouellette was sort of the patriarch of the family, which had lived in Prince George's County, Maryland, up until the 1700s, when they landed in Kentucky. And when John got to Kentucky, you know, he was a third owner of a distillery. He worked for four distilleries over the course of his life, and then the story proceeds from there. But for the purposes of our conversation today, we're going to focus on the Rowan's Creek expression, the small batch idea of whiskey distillers is that they kind of try to create something special and something that is now in many cases small batch is just marketing, right? Because we talked about this on the show last year, a small batch could be as many as, you know, a couple of, well, tens of thousands of bottles, which doesn't really sound all that small. But for the distillery that is calling tens of thousands of dollars, a small batch, that is a reflection of the fact that their output is in the hundreds of thousands of bottles a year. And for smaller distilleries, you know, a couple of thousand bottles might be a small batch. Or for a sort of real ultra small batch, it could be less than 1,000 bottles. But the small batch that I am the small batch that I am looking at here is from batch number 23-76. And that is... you can go find whatever information you need on that batch online. But what's in the bottle is the important thing. And for those of you who have tried bourbon and you know you like more corn-forward bourbons, or you like a little more rye in your bourbon, the percentages are an interesting story. The Rowan's Creek is about 72% corn, and then the remainder is split almost equally between rye and barley. and that's what makes the batch. And it's a 50% by volume alcohol, which means it's a 100 proof. And so that's a fairly stout bourbon. And while a little more story before I get into the whiskey, right? Rowan's Creek, like I say, it's from the Willette Distillery. And one of the interesting things about the Willette Distillery is that in the 1970s, it switched from distilling spirits to distilling ethanol for fuel. And then in the 1980s, it stopped distilling entirely, which I think is a reflection of, it's a reflection of economics, right? And the way economies work. They began distilling spirits again in 2012. And Rowan's Creek was first released in the mid-1990s with a 12-year age statement. And I've mentioned the Noah's Mill earlier, and the Rowan's Creek is sort of a sister bottle to Noah's Mill, which, of course, is a much higher proof. As I said, the Rowan's Creek is a 100.1 proof whiskey. And the age statement isn't on there anymore. It was dropped in the early 2000s. And the last little bit of story, I guess, is the name, Rowan's Creek, right? Rowan's Creek is named for the creek that runs through the Willette Distillery grounds. That creek itself is named after John Rowan, who settled in the area and made a home for himself as a judge and a statesman. And that's where the name Rowan's Creek comes from. So anyway, that's the story. But now it's time for us to get to the whiskey. So now I'm going to do the thing. All right, I've done the thing. And so here's our first pour. Well, that's a pretty generous pour. Oh, well. So on the nose, the first thing I get is a spice overtone to a main sort of vanilla corn sweetness. It's almost like an almond candy. It's really... You can tell that there's a sweetness there, but it's complicated by, as I say, a very interesting spice note, almost nutty. And then that, as it sits in the glass, that goes away, and what's left is just that it's very sort of subtle sweetness on the nose, and I'm hoping that means that it's going to be complicated on the palate, but with a 72% corn ratio, that's probably what it is. That 15% rye is probably where that sort of spice note comes from on the nose. The nose is really nice. All right, so... having done the nose, it's time to put it on the palate and see what it tastes like. All right. So the first impression here is that for as little of the rye as they have mentioned, the rye flavor is actually quite noticeable on the palate. It's very interesting. So it's almost like, this is almost like a rye whiskey. With a fullness from the corn, And that spice from the barley sort of rounding out that rye sharpness, because rye has a tendency to be really stringent. But because of the heavy corn ratio, you just get that little kick of spice from the rye. But the overall flavor, especially on the second sip, is it's giving an impression of sweetness. And the heavy proofing, 100.1% proof whiskey, sorry, not percent, is it's almost, it doesn't taste like it. It doesn't taste overproof. I need another sip. Yeah. And that Kentucky kiss, you know, the warmth that you feel spreading down your throat and into your chest. There it is. Absolutely. So, on first blush, after three small sips, the Noah's Creek out of the Willette Distillery hits all the notes that you want from a straight Kentucky bourbon. You know, it's got the big corn flavor. It doesn't taste like corn, but what corn does in a whiskey like this is that's where that sweet butteriness comes from. It has, as I say, the complication of the rye, so you get a little bit of the sharpness, a little bit of the spice, and it has a really velvety mouthfeel. And I am, you know what, I'm very curious about what some other reviewers would have said in terms of the tasting notes for the Willette Distillery. So let's see what Breaking Bourbon has to say. Breaking Bourbon is one of my favorite sort of go-to sites for interesting thoughts on some of the bourbons that I drink. And, ooh, okay, yeah, all right. So on their take on the nose is that it begins by, quote-unquote, and I'm just going to read from the site here, establishing a sturdy caramel base with layers of vanilla and honey sweetness mingling in. I agree with that. That sort of echoes what I said about the overall first impression of the nose, which is that really the honey sweetness is very prominent. They talk about toasted marshmallow notes, and I didn't get that at all, maybe because my nose is stuffed up, I don't know, but I didn't get any toasted marshmallow notes. And I agree with the light floral grassy scents, which add, according to this review, an unusual dimension. They talk about the sweet bouquet being complemented by a hint of spice, which adds contrast to the fairly balanced aroma. I agree with that 100%. On the palate, this reviewer talked about a medium-bodied palate, which leads with caramel as its most prominent flavor. I disagree. I don't disagree that it's medium balance. That's what I meant when I said that it doesn't taste like an overproof whiskey. But I don't agree that caramel is the most prominent flavor. I think that the most prominent flavor is the sort of unexpected note from the rye, which is definitely mellowed out by the caramel and the softness of the vanilla. But it is, that rye note is there. And so I would not want anybody to drink this without expecting a little sharpness on the very first sip, because otherwise you would think that I was lying to you, and goodness knows that I would never do that. Then the reviewer talks about the raw sugarcane sweetness that layers in. After my third sip, I did get a little, you know, like when I, so when you drink rum, a really nice sipping rum, especially one that's, you know, heavily sugarcane focused, you get almost a sensation of crystallized sugar on your tongue. And so when I think of sugarcane sweetness, that's kind of what I'm expecting. And with this bourbon, okay, sip number four, maybe it is because I'm reading this reviewer's thoughts, but on sip number four, I definitely get some sugarcane. Wow. Okay. Now, that is also possibly a function of the fact that as you are sipping a good bourbon, the flavors continue to develop as you sip. So, you know, maybe I'm being influenced, maybe not. We'll see. And then there is a sort of a grassy floral note, which I actually agree with. And it's one of the things that is really nice about this bourbon. It gives a sense of complexity without being overly precious. And that the grassy and floral notes that are coming are really, they kind of have an ephemeral sort of grace note feature, right? They are there and then gone. And you're like, ooh, what was that? Sip number five. And my palate is now inundated with the sweetness. There's still the structure and that bite from the rye that's there, but it's not at all overpowering. It's truly sensational. I really love this bourbon. Man. The finish is really long as well. And I don't get... And speaking of the finish, you know, occasionally a really strong bourbon will give like a strong sort of spice note on the finish. But what I get here is kind of a restrained, almost the light sting from like a Thai chili, but really like a really minuscule amount of Thai chili added to a dish. So you get a little sting, but it really amplifies the sweetness, and it amplifies the other flavors without detracting from them. So this is incredibly well balanced, and I think it is quite extraordinary. I love this bourbon. So as we chat, I will probably continue to sip. And I hope that that my train of thought, such as it is, continues to be logical and not affected by the 100.1 proof whiskey. But it's balance that I kind of want to talk about a little bit. Because I have been reading the news lately, and I believe that this community, the Bahamas, is severely out of balance. And here's what I mean. We have a story that we sell as a country to the rest of the world about what the Bahamas is. And that story is one thing, and I really don't plan to address that story at all today, because, you know, we all have our views on how true that story might be, right? But the story that we tell ourselves about what the Bahamas is and who Bahamians are is, I think, equally false. It makes me really sad because I remember growing up, I'm 52 now, and I remember as a growing boy thinking that the Bahamas was really defined by family and community. That is what made us unique. That is what made us who we are. That is, to be a Bahamian was to be a person who was cognizant of family connections, cognizant of community identity, and invested in maintaining that community and that identity as integral to one's self-identity. I think it's obvious to me that has changed. We have become so atomized over the last 30 years and more that what was once a community and family-oriented society, and by family I mean extended family. I grew up with my cousins as much as my siblings. And my younger siblings, when they went to party or they went to clubs or they went out for social functions, they often went out with each other. They went out with their cousins and siblings, right? And so that's how I grew up. Now it seems that that atomization has gone through a couple of different phases. Firstly, people's focus narrowed from a broad community focus to an individual family focus, where the goal was to elevate my family by any means necessary. And it seems to me that over the last 20 years, the focus for the country at large, and this is not true for everybody, but I think it's true for the majority, which I believe gives me fair grounds to say that it's true for the country, that the focus has narrowed even further from the family to the individual. And as a result, you see people content to live their lives with their own individual needs, desires, wants as their sine qua non, right? It is, I got to get me, and it's me first, and I have to prosper, and I have to succeed, and things that do not feed into my personal success as an individual need to be cast aside. And I believe we've lost so much when it comes to enrichment of life and enrichment of culture and community because of that focus on individualism. And what makes me sad about that is that I think that focus has been driven so much by financial considerations, right? It's how much money can I make? And if I make enough money for myself, then I will be happy and I will be fulfilled. And there's people make arguments about why that might be, and people make arguments that amount to, in my view, justifications for that kind of thinking and that kind of response to the world. But I think that what the effect of that has been is clear when you read the crime stories. In The Guardian in particular, Artesia Davis. I've known Artesia since 1993, I think, is when we met, when we were both Cub reporters at the Tribune. And Artesia has been covering the courts since then. She's a brilliant writer, and her diligence as a court reporter provides a perspective and a field of knowledge and experience that I really think is unparalleled in the journalism community. I think she knows more about the courts and about what's going on in the crime arena than anybody else in the press corps, for sure. And I think she probably knows more than most police officers and most people who work in the court system about the courts and what's happening in them. And a couple of stories over the last couple of weeks have really struck me as truly problematic. And here's why. These stories sort of exemplify to me what happens in the absence of invested community. Okay, so these are stories that are in the news, so I guess I can talk about them in broad strokes. But in broad strokes, without referring to specific cases, the number of cases that I have read in the news in the last 2 weeks alone that revolve around sexual predators, men who have abused their either children, stepchildren, or people with whom they had contact and people for whom they bore at least nominally some kind of responsibility is staggering to me. I remember asking one of my friends, you know, is this who we are? When you read these stories and you see these men have taken such shameless and reprehensible advantage of their authority and their power over these girls, it is terrifying. It is literally terrifying. And there's a story going around, I think it was in the newspapers on Friday or Saturday of the last week, that suggests it's not only men, obviously, who are taking advantage of their offspring or their charges or the people for whom they are caring. There's a mother who is also being accused of some really heinous behavior. And what strikes me about these things, and the reason I say that we are so out of balance, is that you cannot tell me that nobody knew. Right? Somebody knew. And because we are no longer a community-oriented group of people, the decision was made to not intervene until the matter came to the police. Now, that might not be fair, and I might not have all the facts, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, and I stand to be corrected on that. But the fact that none of this behavior was immediately arrested, immediately stopped, the fact that there was not, in none of these cases, was there an immediate intervention or an immediate intervention by the forces responsible for law and order, tells me that, or it gives me what I believe are grounds on which to base my assertion. And that's the problem. If we are so focused on ourselves and we put such firm blinders on with respect to everything but our own economic and social standing. That means that we're leaving the predators among us free to do what they want. And they are. They most certainly are. And I have a significant problem with that. It breaks my heart on an almost daily basis just to read the news. And I encourage you, if you are not following these stories, go to the Guardian's website and just, you know, pop in Artesia's name, Artesia Davis, and read some of the stories that she is writing out of the courts over the last couple of months. Just read them. And if you don't come away feeling like something needs to change, then I encourage you to check yourself. Check your heart. Because something is wrong. If we read these stories and we are not horrified, something is wrong. If we read these stories and we are not clamoring for immediate change, something is wrong. And when I talk about being out of balance, it's not just that I think that we are out of balance as a people in terms of the fact that we've lost our ability to care for each other because we're so focused on ourselves. I think we are also out of balance as a community in that our, I may get in trouble for this one, but I question the efficacy of our police force. How many of the stories that we've read in the last couple of months, or stories that we know personally, feature somebody calling the police and getting a response that amounts to you on your own? Whether that is, are you sure that's what's happening? Or call us when the situation escalates to a certain level. Or there are no officers here available to address your issue. Or we don't have cars, so we can't come. Or we're on the way, but the police never show up. I could almost guarantee you that if you could turn to whoever you're listening to the show with, ask them, and they, if they didn't experience it themselves, they know somebody personally who tried to call the police for help and didn't get the help they needed. And in some cases, I know people who have called the police for help and gotten a horrible attitude from the police in response. Now, this is not an indictment on all of our police, obviously. I mean, no generalizations are ever 100% accurate. But in my view, the fact that it happens at all is the problem. The fact that it happens at all means that there is some issue about who and what the police are that is in need of addressing. And this is not about manpower. This is not about the equipment that they need, whether that's cars, whether that's, you know, vests, guns, whatever they may need, whatever they may say they are lacking. This is about the attitude to service that is displayed by the people on the police force. I remember when B.J. Nottage, the late B.J. Nottage, was trying to lead a change from the police force to the police service. And people talked about how, you know, the semantics in that situation didn't matter. I think it was BJ Nottage. It might have been Tommy Turnquest, subsequent to BJ. But I'm pretty sure it was BJ. And the argument was, so what if you call it a service? That doesn't mean that that's going to change how they behave. And it's almost like you see it with the prisons, right? When they changed the name of the prison to the Department of Correctional Services, right? The fact is, what you call a thing is indicative, number one, of how you see that thing, and number two, of what you expect that thing to do. And our police force is very much focused on enforcing and not at all, it seems to me, in large part, again, this is a gross generalization, and for those officers to whom this does not apply, please accept my apologies, but they're focused on force, not on service. And I think that that is a part of where we have lost balance. Because I'm fairly certain that if our millennial or Gen Z or Gen Alpha listeners talk to their grandparents, or if they are millennials, they talk to their parents about what the police represented in their communities when they were younger, you would learn that the current manner of policing this community, this country, is not reflective of how things were done in the past. And I'm not talking about the police being involved in crime. It's an entirely separate issue. I'm talking about the attitude towards the community in which they serve that is displayed by the officers in uniform. That attitude used to be that as a policeman, I am a representative of law and order. I am a representative of the good order of the community in which I serve and in which I live. Now, I think it's fairly obvious that the police seem to believe that their job is to catch criminals and that alone, really. And that's really sad because that's only part of the job. That is only a part of the job. All right, so sip number six of the Rowan's Creek Straight Kentucky Bourbon is moving in a really slow, sweet burn across my tongue. Burn is the wrong word. It's because burn sounds strong, and it is not tasting strong. My tongue now has that coating of sweetness that I talked about. There's some grassy, herbal notes that are in there now that I can taste much more strongly. That adds some complexity to this bourbon as I am sipping it. The rye sharpness has really, really toned way, way down. And I think that's really a function of how unexpected it was at the top, you know, when I first started sipping. But as I have made my way through the glass, through the tumbler, excuse me, it is really dimmed and mellowed. I'm talking about the sharpness from the rye now, to almost a background note. You know, like if you're listening to a piece of music, let's say you're listening to Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror, right? And the main chorus and the main vocal are doing their thing, but in the background you hear Michael, come on, whoa, you know, them crazy sounds Michael Jackson used to love to make, right? That's what the Rye is doing. It's occasionally showing up to add some spice and dare I say add some sex appeal to this otherwise sweet and velvety tasting bourbon, and it's really nice. Anyway, so I feel like as a community, and forgive me for preaching, I know this is a very preachy episode. I apologize for this, but this has been on my heart all week. Sorry about that. Yeah, this has been on my heart all week. I feel like we are a community of people who are in desperate need of balance. We need to better balance our search for individual advancement with our sense of community. We need our security and police forces to better balance their jobs combating crime and criminality with their responsibilities to uphold law and good order. We need to better balance our personal journeys as individuals with our journeys as members of a community. And if we can't find that balance, then I think we will continue to spiral. And I don't think there's anybody who would agree, or who would, sorry, I don't think there's anybody who would disagree that the Bahamas is in a bit of a spiral. And the last piece of balance that I think we have lost, the last piece for today's show anyway, is I think we have lost all sense of balance when it comes to our natural environment. Driving down Village Road yesterday, I had the sense that I was driving in the words from an old Bob Marley song came to me, a concrete jungle. The Bahamas, Nassau in particular, has become a concrete jungle because people just cut down all the trees, build up these concrete buildings, and then wonder why everything is so hot. Wonder why we don't feel like we live in an island community anymore. We've cut down all the trees. There's no shade. And we are cutting down everything just to build concrete blocks. And while I cannot argue with the need for housing, the need for new space for new businesses and all of those different things that come with development and come with economic prosperity, which I welcome, let's get that straight, the balance is way off. We've lost it. Anyway, those are my thoughts on balance for today, inspired by the incredibly well-balanced Rowan's Creek out of Willette Distillery in Kentucky. This is a delicious bourbon. I cannot wait for Matthew to taste it. And I would strongly encourage you, if you see a bottle of the Rowan's Creek in one of the liquor stores here, buy it. I got my bottle from Liquid Courage. But if you see it anywhere else, make sure you pick it up. It is a delicious bourbon and definitely well worth the sip. That is my final sip and my final thought for the day. this is definitely going on the list, whatever Matthew said. Anyway, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Thank you for listening to my rant. If you have thoughts, get at me. I'm ready for all the smoke. God bless you. Enjoy your week. K. Quincy Parker, out. Das Vidanya.